You're listening to Encounters in Nature, an open-air dialogue in the North Woods with Celtic polytheist Drew Jacob, voodoo priest Urban Haas, and humanistic pagan B.T. Newberg. Today, we bring you the full-length, unedited, uncensored, more-than-the-sum-of-its-parts director's cut version for the hardcore fan. From the nameless presence of nature to the joys of pooping in the woods, we bring the conversation to you. All this in a crackling fire, today on Encounters in Nature. So what were we listening to there, Drew?
That is a song of praise in Irish to the ancient Irish gods.
That's very beautiful. Thank you. So we're here tonight in the North Woods of Minnesota, not far from Ely. We have our guests here, Drew Jacob.
Hey, everybody.
Author of Rogue Priest and the new e-book, Walk Like a God. We have Urban Haas, author of Chasing the Assomne.
Hello, everyone.
And I'm B.T. Newberg, editor of Humanistic Paganism. We are surrounded by birch woods with the crackle of the fire. We're in front of a lake that's still as glass. And above us, it's a totally clear night with as many stars as you care to count. It's a really beautiful evening.
You guys are missing out. If you're listening to this right now on your computer, I highly recommend throw that computer immediately in the garbage and run outside to experience it. But if you don't do that, we'll do our best to bring it to you.
I see a satellite passing overhead right around 11 o'clock.
Shooting star, Urban. Shooting star.
There was a shooting star.
Yeah, and we're recording this on a Blue Yeti microphone on a MacBook. So let's do this. Tonight we're going to be talking about Encounters in Nature. Three very different traditions coming together to have this conversation. So let's introduce ourselves. Shall we start with you, Drew?
Sure, I'm happy to. Drew Jacob, the Rogue Priest, author at roguepriest.net. People often ask me, am I actually a priest? And the answer is yes, I am actually a priest. Although not the kind most people think. When people hear the word priest in the United States, they usually think of a Catholic priest, which I'm not.
Where's your collar?
Yeah, I know. I always leave that at home. All right. But I couldn't actually be farther from that. I was trained as a priest in the Seán Craidheamh. Seán Craidheamh is the old belief of Ireland, the religion that people practiced before the advent of Christianity there, or at least as close to that as we can manage today. And that's the tradition that trained me and that I've taught for many years, although my own personal spirituality is developing a little bit beyond that. And what I write about now is very much what I practice, which is the heroic life, or the idea of living gloriously, living for high ideals, and making a big impact on the world is the goal. So that's the heroic life in a few quick words.
Yeah. Hello, everyone. My name is Urban Haas. I'm an Ogun of Voodoo. Specifically, I'm an Ogun Serpuen, which means I'm on point. It's kind of the start of the path of priesthood. Just initiated and ready to go on. I am actually scheduled this September to do a Sagwe, which is the last step of initiation. At that point, everything will be complete. Now, I am a priest of New Orleans voodoo compared to Haitian voodoo, which is slightly different, although a lot more similar than some think. And that's me.
And now, Urban, I don't know anything about voodoo. And sometimes when I think of voodoo, I'm thinking of like voodoo dolls, magic, grease, juju. How does that compare to what you do?
Well, you know, voodoo is a tough subject in the United States. It's got a lot of baggage with it, most of it from Hollywood. It's very sensationalized in the movies. Voodoo dolls are actually something that we have nothing to do with as far as the juju or the magic, or which some people might call hoodoo.
He is sticking pins in a doll right now. You can't see it, but he is doing it.
just the microphone. Voodoo is very much a religion and not a magical practice. It's not something that people do for ill gain or for any ill reasons whatsoever. But actually, you know, what we what we do, what we take a vow to do, is to heal and to improve things. So it is very much religion and not at all anything to do with zombies or any of those other things that have been very sensationalized in the movies. And in some ways, it's a byproduct also of racism, since it was a religion originally practiced by the slaves. A lot of people have a very negative connotation with it from those roots and heritage. So there's a lot of racism, either blatant or even passive, that are surrounding the subject.
Interesting. Thank you for enlightening us on that. And I am B.T. Newberg. I am a pagan and a humanist. And recently I've been putting those together. I have taken to calling myself a humanistic pagan. And what I mean by that is someone who embraces the mythology and the spirit of a pagan way of life inspired by pre-Christian European traditions, including ritual, meditation, myths, and, however, taking a naturalistic view to that. The humanism side comes in for me in two basic ways. This is totally simplifying humanism, but first is the naturalistic view, which in another way to put that is not supernatural, but everything is within the material realm of nature. And the other part is responsibility, which I find in humanism, it's distinguished from something like atheism insofar as there's a positive ethical component. Atheism is about what you don't believe in. Humanism is about how you are going to live your life. And that's in a way where humans are seen as capable of and responsible for meeting the problems and the challenges that we face in our lives and in the world, in the environment, all of the challenges that face our species today.
I'd actually like to jump in there. One thing I'll often get asked is, am I pagan? And since Brandon here is a pagan, I will point out that I actually am not. Although people often consider the ancient Irish or ancient Celtic religions part of the pagan milieu, and certainly there is a lot of the neo-pagan tradition nowadays that follows aspects of those traditions. But the truth is that most modern paganism has very little in common with the religion that was practiced in ancient Europe in terms of ceremony, in terms of many of the beliefs and practices.
You're speaking of ritual and tradition?
Ritual and tradition, exactly. And so what we do in my tradition is more based on what was done in the ancient world, and as such don't really consider ourselves part of that pagan movement that's taking hold today. Although the pagan religions are beautiful religions, but it's sort of two different takes, sometimes on the same gods, just like Muslims and Christians worship the same God, but nonetheless two very different religions.
So let me ask you this, since I have the two of you here, and one's obviously pagan, one's saying he's not, how would you define paganism? So that we understand what you're saying you're not. I mean,
sure.
Maybe that would help draw the distinction.
You know, the traditional meaning of the word pagan that has been in use for the longest is really a catch-all term. It doesn't refer to a religion at all in particular. It just means anyone who's not Christian, or a little bit more broadly, anyone who's not either Christian, Jewish, or Muslim. And so it doesn't really refer to any one specific tradition, but just a catch-all term for anything that's not that. So by that loose and really rather bad definition,
I am pagan.
We're all pagans here. In more recent years, in the last century, it's really come to be applied as a name for a specific group of religions, which includes things like Neo-Druidism, Wicca, Celtic Reconstructionism, and a variety of other sort of European myth-based traditions. And so that's what I would consider myself not to be a part of.
Sure.
As much as I respect and love that branch of religions, it's just not actually what I do.
I'm confused, and I don't mean to cause too much dissension here, mm-hmm. but I've heard you speak of Reconstructionism before.
Yeah.
So you're talking about Reconstructionism in one sense, but not the Reconstruction that you practice? Or?
Right. And Reconstructionism is used in two ways as well. And the way that we use it in our tradition is that it's essentially an act. You know, if there's a ceremony that's been lost, and this is what Reconstructionism is, if anyone doesn't know, is the idea that if, you know, beliefs, stories, rituals have been lost when cultures were converted to Christianity and religions were wiped out, that they can sometimes be recovered through scholarship and research or some people would say also through visions and sort of inspiration.
Try to reconnect with the divine that originally imposed those practices to
begin
with.
Right, exactly, and bring it back in some way. And so there are folks who treat that act as a religion into itself, and they tend to fall under the umbrella of neo-paganism. Within our tradition, certainly, since there are a lot of things that were lost in the ancient world, we do engage in reconstruction, but it's sort of just one of many practices that a priest might specialize in and pursue.
Okay. You buy all that?
Interesting.
PT?
I would agree with him on, I would agree with Drew on his definition of paganism, or the way he's described it, and mostly with the reconstruction. I would add, just for the sake of my friends out there who are Hellenic polytheists and reconstructionists, that a lot of them don't necessarily feel that they fall under the umbrella of paganism.
Yeah.
Kind of in the same way that you feel that way.
Yeah, there's a growing movement of that for people sort of, including some reconstructionists and certainly any of the sort of more traditional pagans, starting to step away from the label of pagan and sort of leave that to the neo-pagans and witches and Wiccans and that kind of thing.
Right. And perhaps as the movement grows, or should I say the movements grow and become more and more differentiated, get more and more of a following, perhaps that's appropriate.
You think it's part of the refinement of what paganism actually is and means that causes that kind of distinction between the two, or between the two of yourselves, I mean?
It could be. I'd be perfectly happy, let's put it this way, to see multiple different religions and traditions evolve out of what's going on in our contemporary world. So, if they should find a point of commonality and unity that they can all fit under one umbrella term, super. I don't know if that's going to happen, and I don't think it needs to happen. Mm.
I also am always very dubious when a group is going under a term that not only did they not give themselves, but was not even a very respectful term in the first place. And there are many groups out there that have managed to reclaim terms that were once derogatory. Pagans have not managed to do that. It went from meaning people who have a fake religion or a stupid religion, which is what it meant for a very long time, to meaning kind of a sort of vague, hard to define group of beliefs, or maybe belief isn't that important, and a lot of other things. It's a lot of different traditions and ideas under that umbrella. It's not a good catch-all term.
I find that very interesting because my historical understanding of the term differs from yours. I mean, that I disagree with, you know, the word pagan meant a lot of non-Christians, but my association was always more nature-based, or some kind of nature-based religion, which I only bring it up because that's the topic of tonight.
Right.
Us being out here in nature. That was my understanding of it, and in some ways I wonder how incorrect I've been with that.
Well, so with that idea in mind, so then do you consider voodoo to be pagan?
there's the rub.
I think it would fit with the first definition of the non-Christian, but as far as the nature-based, it's obviously been practiced in nature quite a bit. In fact, especially in the United States in the early days of slavery, it was very much something that was practiced out in the woods, out in the fields, away from the house, or you know, maybe inside something. But no, I would actually push it more towards the realm of ancestor worship, although ancestor worship is actually a phrase that we kind of shy away from, although that happens somewhat privately in the home. That's not really what the religion's about. It's more of a connection to the divine as much as we can through the intermediaries of the Loa. So as far as that's concerned, no, I don't know if I'd fit under the pagan umbrella from that sense either. So I guess I'm with you. I'm not pagan.
And I'm curious, that connection with the divine or the Loas, is the divine seen as part of or within nature? Are they separate from or super nature, supernatural?
For anyone listening, by the way, Loas are, would it be fair to say gods in the...
No, it's definitely
not. It's
not fair.
It's definitely
not fair. Spirits.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's what we mean by Loas.
Yeah. Voodoo is a monotheistic religion. Mm-hmm. There is one god, and he is very remote and very far from us, and we can't actually reach him in the traditional sense. So we have the intermediaries, those that have gone before us and that have died and that have been... so profound or exceptional that they have lived on in that sense as more of an archetype, and they're the intermediaries for us. As far as what I consider that natural, supernatural is probably closer. You know, we talk about the invisible world, the world behind this one. So, in one sense, yeah, part of it is natural. That's this world. Mm-hmm. And part of it is supernatural. That's the other world. So it's almost both.
Now, was it really all, I mean, is it really monotheistic? Or is it sort of, you know, 300 years ago they would have really seen it as many gods, and since that would get them frowned upon by Christians, it's sort of been rebranded a little bit, sort of a new lingo added to it to make it more acceptable.
I don't think so. You know, in the earliest Loa, I mean, they are more telling the story of man and how man came to be with the first life. So I don't consider that godlike, although some people might think that our earliest ancestors were more godlike in the sense that they were the progenitors of our race. I wouldn't quite call that God. And yeah, at least my understanding of it today is no. That is not the case. The closest analogy actually is that of the Catholic saints as the intermediaries in Catholicism to God, although I know some Christians don't believe that and some do. That's probably the closest analogy in some ways how voodoo can be syncretic with Christianity in a way, or at least with Catholicism.
So in what respect does nature come into your spiritual path as you realize your voodoo tradition?
There's a pause there. you know, that's a good question. And how much does nature come into it? Obviously, there are so many common natural elements, and I'm going to get myself confused and lost and drift around. Because part of it is, you know, more personal than that, too. For me, I have a strong meditative tradition, and from the Himalayas, from the Vedic traditions. And with that, one of the things that I have with nature, of course, that draws me in immediately is, you know, when I get out into a natural setting such as this, sometimes I want to sit down and meditate. That's one side of it. I have another side of me is more playful than that. I want to jump in the lake. You know, so nature has a very many different pulls and pushes. As far as how much does nature play, that's a good question. I did find myself going up to northern Minnesota last Halloween, because I was unable to go down to New Orleans to celebrate Day of the Dead, so I went up into the North Woods, up in the middle of the state, and did a ceremony up in the North Woods. And that, to me, was a very natural and a very connection-oriented way to do it. Voodoo is traditionally practiced, at least in open air, more Caribbean-style places without doors and windows, per se, that are open. And in that sense, you know, like I said back in the earlier days, you know, out in the woods, there is that natural element to it. And the biggest thing about voodoo that I've been told and I agree with is what you really have to be able to do with voodoo is dance. And it's very much an active religion, an active participation religion.
And by dance, are you talking about something metaphorical, or you're talking about
I mean
actual dancing?
It is a full contact religion.
Do you wear pads?
No, we do not. It's very active. I mean, you know, you get up and you move and you do things, and it's not the kind of religion where, you know, you sit there and someone talks to you. It is very actively participated with everyone that's there, no matter what their position, no matter what their background.
Experiential.
Yeah, it's very experiential.
Now, Drew, I know from your ebook, Walk Like a God.
Best well book ever written. The greatest book in the world.
As well as from all your writing, that nature plays a big role for you in your spirituality.
Right, yeah. It does. And this is the thing, is that anyone spiritual who thinks that they are not a nature person or not a big fan of nature is either misinformed or or misrepresenting their spirituality.
There's someone out there right now that feels offended.
That person should go in the woods right now.
Right there.
people frequently refer to themselves, well, I'm not a nature person. They mean by that maybe you don't like going camping, or maybe you don't like bugs or the rain, or you know, like the idea of hunting or fishing or these kinds of things. You don't get your recreational time in by going outside in the wild for long periods of time. But that's not the only way people connect with nature. And we are beings who have evolved through a very lengthy process of living in the wild. And through the vast majority of our history as a species, We have not lived in houses. We have not isolated ourselves from the elements or from nature. For most of our history, we were hominids, and then before that, primates, and before that, many other kinds of creatures. And it is hardwired into each and every person listening here to respond to the cues of nature. And when you walk outside somewhere that is full of life, when you walk near trees and plants, if you're somewhere that has those, or if you're in the desert, you get that beautiful vista that lets you see how far out the land reaches and where the next, you know, place to find water might be. Your body responds to that. And I don't care if you've spent the last 30 years in an office building and spend your weekends indoors watching movies, if you go out for a short walk in the woods, you will get that response. It's hardwired into us. We find medicine, we find food, we find water, we find places that are safe for us to live, that are sheltered from predators and from the elements. This is in your genes. So everyone out there can feel a sense of exhilaration and coming to life when they go outside and embrace the elements a little bit. And that includes even people whose religion or whose hobbies have nothing to do with going outside. So you're all nature people. Take off your clothing right now.
Okay. So you're a nudist.
We're all naked here. We're naked with voodoo dolls. You got to participate, okay?
It's what very else are you going to do in the North Woods?
It's just true this naked, really.
It's really just me. They've been trying to get me to put clothes on for 2 days.
Well, I would agree with you that nature is very important, and I think it's a very personal thing. I know there are a lot of people out there who don't necessarily identify with nature the way it's usually defined. And so I guess in talking about my view of nature and how it works into my path, I guess I want to start by kind of exploring what I mean a little bit by that, because usually when we talk about nature, we mean wild nature, especially in the American view of the wilderness as a nature, something that is not man-made, that is pristine or near to it, and that you go out into it and experience this non-man-made environment. Well, that's one view of nature, but I think that nature, I prefer to think of nature as being more encompassing of that, that it includes the human, it includes the imagination, because we come out of nature, we are born of nature,
we're in the natural
part
world.
Of nature. Mm-hmm. And the natural world is in us.
Yeah.
And I think of, I conceive of a distinction between wild nature and, I guess, what you could call...
urban nature?
Urban nature? Domesticated nature?
Yes.
I don't know. I have to think of a term that's not derogatory of it, but which includes the human. Mm-hmm. And wild nature, I would include both the pristine, non-man-made natural environment, as well as those depths of the subconscious that are really beyond your conscious control. I see that as another frontier, an inner frontier of nature. So I think of something a little more all-encompassing when I talk about nature. And I think people who grew up in the city or wherever they may be, that they come about that they just don't identify with the wild nature in terms of like trees and mountains and rivers, that there's more to it than that, and they can also find nature in their city streets, in their parks, in their water fountains, in the architecture of their city hall, and in their own dreams, and in their own recesses of their private moments.
I agree with that in spirit.
Ooh. Dissent. You hear dissent.
Go on.
The pagan and the non-pagan speak.
I really do. I agree that there, you know, obviously we are creatures formed by nature, and there are, you know, aspects of that nature within our imagination, within our psyche. And, you know, certainly there are, you know, little, you can have a house plant, you can have a fountain, that kind of stuff. But
a cat.
When we're talking about the intersection of spirituality and nature, it's important to come to terms with the fact that you need to actually change something to get a different result. And for all the people out there who feel this sense of spiritual longing or feel like there's something bigger that they can connect to, that there's something more out there, you actually have to, you know, work to get to that. It does take a certain amount of,
you mean effort.
It takes some effort, yes.
Yeah.
And you're probably not going to find it in your house. You're probably not going to find it in the same streets you walk down every single day.
I do know some people that have meditation rooms in their homes.
This is very true. Meditation is helpful. But it's really when you get out of your element, when you get out of your comfort zone, and remember that the way that most of us live is not the way we were designed to live. And when people feel a sense of being disconnected or feeling like they're missing something, it's oftentimes because we are not the nomadic people we were evolved to be.
Do you feel like we're living an unnatural life then?
That's interesting. I think, yeah.
You know, humans for a long time have congregated together in close groups and in social settings. And I think the cities in some aspects are
correct.
An extension of that.
Yeah, in a way. But I think, you know, it's not just about being disconnected from nature as like the wilderness, but also in terms of, you know, do you still live in a single room with a lot of relatives? Do you see people routinely that you love? Is your residence located more than a mile from the next nearest residence so that you have room to breathe and spread out and not feel, you know, there's a lot of things that go into the human psyche that are not, the way we live now is not the way we were evolved to live. I'm not saying you should all give up your houses and run out to the middle of nowhere.
There's not enough room.
There's not enough, yeah, leave nowhere to us, okay? We're holding it down out here. But those stresses are there. And until you step outside of that life and accept that maybe it's not the ideal life, then it's going to be hard to find a different result.
But why does it have to be in wild nature? For example, I know you've done, for example, urban spelunking, which consists of, for example, going through tunnels of like sewers and things in it, almost Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles type of style.
There was a lot of ninja going on.
Yeah.
The Goonies.
Or if you, if you're talking about going out of your element, out of away from your familiar household, going into a different neighborhood, with
or
a different
gallery.
Social class, economic class, or culture than you're used to, and finding your way there.
I think that's a super powerful practice, and I think I wish more people would do it. Travel changes you, and even short term, if you can't travel across the world, you know, travel to a new part of your town or the next town over, absolutely.
To get on the bus.
Get on the bus.
Go to the museum.
Still naked.
Go to the zoo. Go to the pool. Take a class. Expand your mind.
I'm on board with that.
Okay.
Yes.
So what I'd really love to hear now is, I mean, we've now seen that we're all coming from fairly different.
I disagree.
Perspectives.
Now who's being contrary?
Not without common ground. But I'd like to hear about how we come together to this one thing that we have in common, which not just us, but everybody in the world has in common, and that is this earth, this wild nature that is still available in a few places in the world, and to hear what that experience is like for each of us.
So it's story time?
It's story time.
Story time.
Why don't you go first, BT?
All right. Well, I'll share a relatively recent experience, which was just last week, actually. Mm-hmm. My fiance and I, she's also a humanist.
Humanist pagan?
She's not a humanistic pagan.
Okay.
She's more of the secular humanist.
Okay.
So we are on the same page with some things, but not others. But we get along quite well. But she also has a little bit of that wonder and that vision of nature that I notice sometimes comes through in her. And there was a moment when I was coming home to my apartment. This is in the city, in Minneapolis, where I live. And I was going by one of the brownstone apartments just across the street from my own apartment. And this one is covered in ivy creeping along the wall of this old brownstone apartment. And I noticed that there were there was this kind of green dust along the sidewalk underneath it. And as I was passing by, I looked up at the ivy creepers, and all of these seeds were just raining down all at once. It was the most really touching and beautiful experience because, for one thing, because I had no idea that all those seeds came down at once, and like it was just dropping like about 10 per second and just continuously. But also because I looked at that and I thought to myself, geez, I wish my fiance could be here seeing this because I know she would love it. And there was sort of a tragic beauty to that because the experience of nature is often a very private and internal experience. And you can have other people that share the same experience, but it's not necessarily the same experience for each person. There's also a diversity of perspectives on the same experience. And to me, there's certain tragedy in how private that is, but it's also beautiful for that aspect. It's fleeting, it's unique, and it's your own. And so I was just appreciating that as I was watching these seeds fall from the ivy. And then I went back to my apartment, and I wasn't in my apartment more than about 5 minutes, and who walks in but my fiance, and she looks at me and she says, "Oh my God, across the way, the ivy creepers, the seeds are just raining down. It was so beautiful." And I looked at her and she looked at me and I was like, "I just saw the same thing. I can't believe you saw that too." And it was...
So it was a shared experience.
It was separately. A shared experience after all. Yes.
Did you guys then make love? Is that where the story is going?
Oh, burning, mad, passionate love.
Monkey love.
Excellent. Good.
So that was a moving experience of nature for me. And to relate it a bit to humanistic paganism, I do like to mythologize the way I experience nature to an extent. For example, I enjoy Greek mythology, so Dionysus, the god of vegetation as well as wine and revelry and indomitable life, is what I really think of when I walk past those ivy creepers day after day after day. But I have to say, when I'm actually gripped in the moment of an experience of nature like that, when I have one of those experiences where nature grabs me by the hair, like Athena grabbing Achilles in the Iliad, it's a wordless experience. Not of a particular deity or legend. There is no name for it. And it's just a presence. And it's beautiful.
Hear, hear.
It's well told. Do you want to go next, or should I?
Go for it.
Ah, okay. Was I ready for that? I've had some wonderful experiences in nature and pilgrimages and lovely places that I've traveled to, whether they be islands in the Caribbean or going down to Belize in Central America, or you know, traveling through India, doing camel safari. But I actually want to, going on some of the things you guys have been saying, hit something closer to home. One of the things I found particularly magical in the city of Minneapolis, actually, is taking a trip down to the dog park down by Minnehaha Falls. I have two dogs. I've had two dogs for a long time. They haven't always been the same two dogs, but taking my dogs down there, there's, I can't remember what the actual number is. I think it's like 17 acres of land that is off-leash, you know, fenced in, but on the banks of the Mississippi River. And taking them down there and walking, I find it an incredibly magical place. First of all, it's forest. Second of all, it's on the beach. You can walk along the shores of the Mississippi. You can sit there. And there's this incredible amount of trails that you can just walk and hike. And walking through these trees, some of them which are just hundreds of years old, and others of which they're on the banks of the Mississippi, and the roots are exposed because the sand and the dirt's been washed away by the river flooding. And then there's high trails up on the tops of bluffs, and you can walk down the bluff to the river and walk back up the bluff onto the trail. It's just been a truly magical experience for me. That is one way I would connect with nature, just kind of in a cityscape setting almost, but yet still very natural, close to home.
So my relationship with the wilderness is a lengthy and sometimes rocky love affair. but I've made an effort in my life to increasingly go out and spend time in nature as such, and to do that without trying to impose my own way of life on it. So growing up, we went camping all the time, and it was like most camping. We'd take a tent, and we would take food, and we would take a lot of amenities with us. And sure, we'd cook on the fire and sleep in sleeping bags, but it was not exactly in the bosom of the wilderness. It was much more of a controlled experience.
Was it a community campsite, or was it more of a just out in the middle of nowhere?
Well, with my family, it was pretty much always a community campsite, okay. Yeah, some kind of state park or something like that. With actual, like, you know, roads they go to, designated camping areas, sure. and so forth. As I got older, because I fell in love with nature in those years. I loved that camping, but as I got older, I thought, well, I want to really experience nature, and I would start taking less and less with me. And after that went badly a few times, started then thinking, well, I better learn how this is done properly. And eventually, after enough years of kind of becoming more and more of an outdoors person, I went and spent about 3 weeks one summer with a group of hunter-gatherers at a wilderness school in northern Wisconsin, and actually lived in, you know, I would say 95% full hunter-gatherer lifestyle, which I don't recommend that everyone run out and do that. It's really incredibly trying. it's not just, you know, that you're outside or that you might get rained on. It's so many hundreds of little things that you take as just part of your everyday routine when you're living in your house in the city or the suburbs or the country, that you can maybe do without for a few days on a road trip or a camping trip, but as time wears on, your mind gets fixated on them.
For example?
Bread, having the ability to have a set of solid walls with a locking mechanism that seals you into a place at night rather than just like
the home base.
You know, yeah, things are creaking and blowing and walking by you and things like that. Being able to spend an hour without checking yourself for ticks. Having something deep fried. Having something that's sweet. Sweeter than just berries, like chocolate, something like that. These things are all really unnecessary. They're absolutely unnecessary for a human to be happy. But if you're used to them from 20, 30, 40 years of life, going cold turkey on all of them at once is incredibly challenging. So that was really what most of those 3 weeks with the hunter-gatherers was.
I don't know if I could go with coffee.
Yeah, and there was no coffee. No, there was no source of caffeine. No alcohol, which was big for me. No fermented, smoking allowed, actually.
Fermented berries?
You know, I probably could have got away with that. Yeah, if I was fermenting berries out in the wilderness, they might have turned a blind eye to that. But they did ask people not to bring any kind of substances. You know, no alcohol, no marijuana, no nicotine, none of these things. Even though some of those are very natural and might be used in ceremony by many hunter-gatherer cultures. But when you're going through that really difficult experience, if you're using those to lean on, you're going to hit them really hard. So they've just learned not to allow newcomers to bring that stuff. So it was a very, very interesting time. And so many things. My first night there, someone had caught a turtle, which is not hard. I mean, if you see a turtle, you've caught a turtle. It's like success.
It's not a snapping turtle, I take it.
Right, yeah. Well, I mean, for all I know it was, but it's, you know, it's pretty basic. And so among the standard diet, which I would soon come to accept was going to happen every single day, of boiled deer meat, in addition to that, they had cooked up this turtle. And, you know, they said, well, the very best part of the turtle is the feet. Because it's got all the good fat in it and all this oil. And so, you know, in honor of our new guest, Drew, we'll give him one of the 4 feet. And, we'll, you know, they usually would just give those to the elders or whoever, you know. Maybe the person who hunted it would get one of them and the elders would get the rest or something. But, like, you know, since it's his first night in our camp, let's give him the turtle foot. Which I accepted with, you know, an undue sense of pride, having really done nothing to earn the turtle foot. And I pretty quickly started to suspect that maybe they were just joking.
This is like Rocky Mountain oysters.
Yeah, I was like, is this actually, am I supposed to put this in my mouth? You know, and I didn't want to be insulting because it seemed to be a big deal that they had given it to me.
Pick on the new guy.
And so I kind of just, you know, waited and I started looking around to see if anybody else eating theirs. And, you know, sure enough, they put theirs in their mouth. So I thought it must be safe. But I tell you, a turtle foot, it's like, you know, actually right now, look around your house, see if you can find maybe like a belt, and just like a leather belt, and just put that in your mouth and start chewing on it. And when you get through that and it's ready to be, you know, ingested, then send me an email, because it's going to take you a while.
It took you a while to masticate the turtle, huh?
It did. And you're trying to, you know, get this turtle leather off of, like, kind of a claw that kind of sucked the toe fat out. And it's, you know, not neither easy nor appealing. So you don't even feel that motivated to do it, except that they really gave you this treat. And that was my first night at the hunter-gatherer camp. So that gives you a sense of sort of the pace of which I was, you know, moving here. During that time, though, this is what I'm getting at, is that my relationship to nature changed dramatically, because when you spend time away from a, you know, quote-unquote civilized life, which can be in the countryside, people in the countryside are not particularly any more nature-oriented than people in the city. They're still living off the same commodities, but anytime you're dealing with agriculture, you're not really getting in tune with nature. But my relationship started to change. If you go without that lifestyle for a while, you can get over it. I mean, yes, you want your coffee, you want your, like, you know, bed that's actually soft and not the ground. You want temperature control, but after a while, you don't. You just don't care anymore. It goes away. And you start to just adapt to your new lifestyle. And once that happens, you can start to view nature in a very different way. It's no longer this, you know, private, amazing experience. It's not something to be tamed. It becomes the backdrop to everything you do, and it becomes almost communicative. It's, you're really reading a million cues a day. You know where things are. You know what you can put in your mouth. You know where not to step. You can hear people coming long before you can see them. You just become aware on so many different levels, using senses in ways that we just don't in the city. Smell is amazing. I mean, when the human nose gets to work, you can smell, you know, a lot of things. And you can follow, you know, I'm not going to say you can follow a trail, but you can tell when something is safe to eat, even if you don't recognize that plant. You can, you know, you can sniff out things that you maybe shouldn't be able to sniff out. And it also becomes very comforting.
Shouldn't be able to?
You know, yeah. I mean, you know, people don't bathe in the woods so much.
Yeah, okay.
But it becomes comforting on a level, because we don't smell each other in the city.
No.
Or on the farm, if we can help it. And that essentially means you're walking around blind in one of your five senses every day. Well, everyone covers up their smells.
I think we've tried to do that on purpose.
That's, well, but we've tried to do that on purpose in cities.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, it gets disgusting, you know, if there are that many people in a close area. In the wilderness, you're talking about a small group of people spread over a great distance. You never have to get so close that it's uncomfortable, that you feel like the person's stinking up the place. You never have to deal with someone else's sewage. It's never gross. But when you were able to be in proximity and kind of notice that slight musky scent, not bad BO, but just that, you know, I've been sweating all day walking in the woods kind of scent, you start to be able to see the other human beings around you in all five of your senses, and not just in the four that we restrict ourselves to normally. And it is, in a weird way, it's a deeply emotionally gratifying experience. It's as if you've been blind your whole life.
I have to ask. So you went through this wilderness thing.
Sure.
And obviously you give up a bed, and you give up a house, and you give up all these comforts. What about clothing?
Interesting. You know,
Did you stick with that?
Or was it
part-time?
Or? Well, I was there because I was there for a shorter period of time. I remained with my own wardrobe.
Okay.
And I took, you know, basic things, some long pants, some shorts, some t-shirts. I learned a few things about how to adapt to living in the wild, such as throwing away my hiking shoes after like 3 days and just using soft shoes the whole time. But if I had been there longer, I would have done what many of them did and give up the kind of, you know, modern clothing and get a, you know, maybe some leather breeches, but that's a little bit of a pain in the ass to make. A lot of them would just wear leather loincloth, which is extremely handy. So that kind of stuff, yeah.
I mean, because clothing isn't always just about modesty. Sometimes it's about protection, right?
It is, yeah.
Yep. And protection from getting scratched by the thorns that you're walking by, or okay, I'm just
love
curious.
That. And also access. You know, when you got the leather loincloth on, it's so much easier to go to the bathroom in the woods than if you've got to deal with your pants. I mean, if it's a number two, or for ladies anytime. But pooping in the woods is a whole epic unto itself. But I will stop hogging the spotlight. The point being, my relationship with nature changed, and I view it now not so much as sort of a, you know, this abstract concept or like nature with a capital N, and more as it's just the way, it's the happiest way to live. It's mm-hmm. it's what we were designed to do.
Well, I live on a hobby farm in Minnesota, and, you know, it's probably like a half step or maybe even a quarter step or maybe even an eighth step towards what you're talking about. it's not the quantification that I'm actually concerned about, but moving out from the suburbs to the middle of nowhere, you know, the nature starts to hit you every day. Mm. I mean, I can sense weather patterns that I wasn't able to sense when I was in the city.
Yeah,
and I mean, I know if we're having a wet summer or a dry summer, I know if, you know, if it's going to rain soon. Or you can kind of feel things that are different that I just wasn't in tune with before. And that was really, really interesting for me. I mean, we used to go camping out in Wyoming every year and camp with a tent, but not in a organized campground in the middle of nowhere, places where you could be comfortable taking your clothes off just with you know, you and your wife. And
my camera.
And no, there was no camera. But my dogs were there, and they let their noses pick up if someone was coming around.
Sure, yeah.
But no, you can hear vehicles coming. You can hear things coming. You can hear the bugs and the birds, and things get quiet, and you're like, okay, something's going on. What is it? But my point being is, you know, one of the things that's changed for me is since we moved out to the country, we used to take all these camping trips out in the wilderness. And now, since we moved out to the country, we tend to take all these trips into the city. And that to us is more of an adventure because it's like we live out in nature all the time, and not to the extreme that you're talking about, but it's like we have that camping experience or that outside nature experience so much now that now we kind of crave the urban life.
Right, yeah.
And so now, you know, before where we never really vacationed in cities, now we go and vacation in cities, which is just kind of different. Nice. But
yeah, I had a similar experience growing up in a very small town, about the same size as the town that you're in now or that you grew up in.
Yeah, it was our city's like 1,200 people. So
yeah, I grew up in a city of about 1,100 and something, and it was 30 minutes to the nearest McDonald's, and it was a treat, let me tell you, when our family went to McDonald's.
Yep.
And that's how it should be.
Yeah, this is Minnesota. Know? We're looking for a DQ. Come on.
But I also have to say that that area that I grew up in, which is south central Minnesota, was agriculture land. It was completely flat. It was the kind of environment that you think of when you think of Illinois, Iowa, lots of cornfields, etc. If you look at it from above, from an airplane, it looks like a checkerboard because all the fields are cutting it up and the roads are graph-like on the landscape.
Yeah, it's like a grid.
And so I didn't feel, as I was growing up, even though I was immersed in this, in plant life and animal life, I didn't feel like I was connected to nature because it was very man-made. And in a sense, I'm going against a bit the way I was defining nature earlier. But in terms of wild nature, I didn't feel connected to that. And I do think that there is a very important distinction in terms of experience between the wild nature and then the human nature. And there's something very sublime about encountering the wild nature. And I definitely acknowledge and embrace that powerful experience of going beyond the realm of what is familiar to man, to humanity.
So what is it you're seeking then?
What am I seeking?
Yeah, I mean, are you seeking to break out? When you say, you know, you're looking for this wild nature, I mean, what are you trying to experience, or how would you define even wild nature?
Well, I mean, it's always a kind of a ad hoc definition. But, I mean, if you could kind of just break it up between what is familiar to man and within sort of the realm of his control and that which feels beyond his control.
Well, while you're thinking, one of the experiences we had today, the three of us out canoeing, was, you know, I'm like, it's nice to be in a place where, you know, we're like a very minority compared to the creatures that are living around us. You know, we're not surrounded by lots of other, there's not really many other people staying out here. I suppose there's someone across the lake, but it was nice to be feeling like we're not the majority species in this dense little clump. Of land. Is that what you mean by wild, or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I definitely say that. It's a very different experience. I value both kinds of nature, but I really enjoy and identify a lot with the wild aspect of nature. And there's a different sort of relationship, I think, because especially if you're more or less alone in it, or if you just have a few trusted friends with you, a lot of your interaction is no longer with humans and human-made things, but it's with trees, the trail you're on, the thing that's brushing against your foot right now that you don't know what it is, the sound of the water off somewhere where you're not quite sure, but it's off on the other ridge. And that kind of, it puts you in your place. And sure. I think that's healthy.
It can be disorienting too. I mean, when we used to go camping out in Wyoming, we'd spend like 7 days without seeing anyone else. And then we go into a grocery store and we go into culture shock. I remember one experience, we were going into this grocery store in Wyoming, and you know how sometimes in the grocery store the produce, well, they'll spray it. You know, like a little water will turn on and mist everything up and keep it wet and fresh. Mm-hmm. So we're walking through this grocery store, and all of a sudden there was this sound of thunder. And the lights flashed, and then the water started on the produce. And it was just so surreal to us that we couldn't handle it. We had to get out of there.
Drew, when you were talking earlier, what really struck me about the way you were describing your experiences is you're very... sensual in the way you're describing it. Very sense-based. And you could describe the nuances of what you were experiencing, not in abstract terms, but in how it was actually coming to your five senses.
Right, yeah.
And to me, that is a very important aspect of spirituality, because to me, we experience the world beyond us and the world of which we are a part through the five senses. And being mindful of our experience moment to moment, being present with that, is freeing and liberating in a way that is rarely experienced in the common day-to-day, job-dominated, work-dominated consciousness that we tend to, by habit, live our lives in. And when we take that moment to take a break from that, whether it's through meditation in our own homes, or whether it's through going out into the wild nature or semi-wild regions of nature, it's therapeutic and profound.
I agree. I think that that's to me, that's, I don't disagree in any way. I completely agree that that is true. But to me, my relationship with nature is different than that. It's, to me, the idea of using it as sort of the therapy, or sort of the release in between a life that is stressful, is not appealing. It's about the breakthrough experience of starting to actually understand the world that we live in.
I can identify with that.
When you spend a lot of time, you know, out in nature, and learning to live within nature, so taking your food from nature, building your shelter from nature, etc., rather than bringing those things with you or going back to them, it stops being an unknown, it stops being a mystery, and it becomes a comfort, because the things that we need in life, so food, shelter, and so forth, are things you can just get freely from nature. There's never ever a concern of, well, what if I starve? Once you know how to gather things and how to hunt things and so forth, there's really no such thing as a famine in a hunting and gathering society. Famines are usually dependent on people storing large amounts of crops and needing to, you know, grow them over a certain season and store them for a later season, and then something going wrong, a drought with that one crop, or a pestilence, or a war. In nature, there are hundreds or even thousands of different kinds of edible things that are coming in and out of season at all times. I've never been to a grocery store that has as many varieties of food as a couple of acres of Minnesota forest. And when you start to realize that everything you could ever need, literally everything, can just be gathered for free off of the ground. It's like shelter, and I don't, when I say shelter, I don't mean like you're going to be miserable living in like, you know, a little pile of dirt. It's like, no, you can actually build comfortable shelter out of fallen trees and so forth. It's going to be warm in the winter, dry year round, cool in the summer, and you can find a really rich, varied diet that's healthy and has some sweet things and some protein and lots of greens. You can just pick that up just walking around, and it's free. It just happens. And people often think of, they focus on the dangers of nature. Like, well, what if I was attacked by a bear or a mountain lion? That's possible. But, you know, you also learn how to avoid or drive off bears and mountain lions. And it stops being sort of this scary, momentous, abstract force, and it does become central. It becomes, you know, I don't want to undermine the fact that nature can be dangerous, but nature is also incredibly generous, and it just gives whatever you need. It's never withheld.
So I've heard someone describe you as hardcore. And this sounds pretty hardcore. I mean, right. I think that for a lot of us, we fear the unknown. And what makes nature very scary is there's a lot we don't know about it, so therefore, it's scary.
Right.
And, you know, I know you've gone through a lot of these training and practices to, to kind of train you and get you knowledgeable to know what to eat and what not to eat and, you know, how to survive. But getting back to maybe some of your stories or your book or whatever, I mean, how do you make this more accessible to most people instead of something that may be completely unrelatable to them?
That's a good point.
In their day to day?
Well, it is something we all have the ability to do. And, you know, when I first started, I didn't just walk out in the wilderness with a hatchet and go about building myself shelter. I think if people have an interest in learning...
You said you might have tried that and it was a disaster.
I did try some increasingly difficult camping trips, but I wasn't quite that hardcore until I'd had some training. But, let's put it this way. You don't want to just walk out and just throw yourself into it. You know, if you're interested in that kind of thing, set it up as a personal goal or a challenge. And maybe the first summer, and do it in summertime to start with, because that'll make it a lot easier for you. You go out to a wilderness school and learn some basics of how to track or how to forage or how to build shelter and put it to the test over a course of 3 or 4 days. And, you know, do that a few times. Then maybe you build it up to a week, or maybe you try going in the autumn or the spring when it's a little bit tougher, but you're not going to lose a foot to frostbite. And, just build it up slowly and don't go past your confidence level. It's like learning anything else that's potentially dangerous but highly rewarding. If you start way beyond your skill level, you'll have a miserable time and maybe get hurt. But if you start with the basics and learn it and build it up slowly, you'll have amazing discoveries. And it is in every single one of us. And if you're not sure, if you're thinking, well, you know, that probably isn't my kind of thing, there's nothing wrong with just trying it for one weekend. Get out of your comfort zone and try it out.
And if it's a disaster, you got the car right there.
You got the car right there. Yeah, take your cell phone with you in case there's a problem, and, you know, just take good common sense. But yeah, there's nothing more transformative than truly not just living in nature with your bubble of stuff, but starting to live from nature. Hmm. Plus, when you learn to enjoy pooping in the woods, it's one of the best experiences in life.
I tend to agree with you on that one.
So, I guess I have one more thing that I'm wondering about for all of us, and that is, and this is going to be a slightly funny question depending on what your perspective on nature is, and but
nature sucks.
No,
that's why we're here.
When you go out into nature, whatever that means to you, and you have a profound experience, whatever that means to you, and then you go back to your daily life, what do you bring back with you, in a sense? What do you value from that can continue on throughout your life?
Well, I'll start with that one. I think we've already answered that, first of all. and the reason I say that is we talked about, you know, a transformative experience that changes you. Obviously, that becomes a part of you, and that part of you goes back and sees things a bit differently than it did before. So hopefully, you know, when you go out in nature and either you do some camping with a tent or a cabin or in a boat, whatever it is that you do, you're having experiences that tend to make you see things a little bit differently. I mean, the case in point that I'm going to make here is, you know, we're out here in northern Minnesota, and there are thousands and thousands of stars overhead. Mm. And I can't see that in the sea. I know I can't. Mm. You know, I mean, maybe I'm lucky to see three. or maybe I'm lucky to see a dozen, depending upon what kind of city I'm in. But that's a vision that I can see right now that, you know, stays with me. And I know that they're there, no matter where I am, no matter what I'm doing. I can remember that. And that's just one tiny example of, you know, jumping in the lake at night when the water's warmer than the air, or, you know, cooking in a campfire, or, you know, whatever that experience is for you, hiking in the woods, maybe by yourself, maybe with some friends. It's something that you take with you because it changes who you are. Mm. And those kinds of experiences, to me, are highly spiritual in a way because they lift up your spirit.
Hmm. Definitely. I would agree with that 100%.
My answer to the question would be confidence and freedom. Hmm. When you come back from that kind of intensive trip in the woods, when you come back from living with nature, even just the first time you've done it, there is this sudden sense of possibility, of knowing that no matter what happens with your life, like if your career goes awry, or if you were to lose your house, or all these other things,
you could be a mountain man someday.
You know you could be. You could be a hermit in the woods, and or a part of a community in the woods, and that you're, you know, the price of failure is not necessarily that you're going to be a hobo eating garbage and sleeping with newspaper over you in the winter. There you have the option of living, not eking out a sad existence, but of living a happy, fulfilling life at any time you want in the woods for free, with really very little to no money needed to start, and everything you need on an ongoing basis for free, except for companionship, which you can bring with you. And once you realize that, once you know, first of all, that you've seen your own hands and your own body make it through something you once thought was impossible, but then the added dimension of what that means, of the fact that you could live completely a satisfying life for free, nothing can really scare you or faze you anymore. It becomes more and more of a sense of understanding that all of the stuff you're doing in your career or school, or with your family, or you know, the rat race or whatever else, is really something you're choosing to do. It's not something you have to do. And that's an incredibly liberating experience.
That's freedom.
It's freedom, yeah. I mean, suddenly you realize, like, you know, is there a reason I'm doing this? And if so, you focus on that and you have a goal. And if there's not a reason you're doing it, you don't like doing it, then you can change it. A lot of people don't get that.
Mm-hmm. Must be very empowering. I mean,
it is.
You know, like I said earlier, I think nature is very scary for people, and to be able to conquer a fear is a very empowering and liberating experience, like you described.
Right. Yeah, good point.
And it must also be quite an experience of, as you said, confidence, as well as willpower, because I can only imagine that anyone who embarks upon that is going to encounter no shortage of naysayers.
Yes.
From their family, friends, bosses.
Yep.
Pretty much all directions coming at you.
Correct.
And yet, if you can continue to summon that will to follow that dream and discover that truth about yourself, that you can live free in that sense, what does that mean for your self-esteem, for your value of yourself as a person, and for your value of life as a whole?
And a sense of integrity, that you don't ever have to sell out or do something you don't agree with in order to get by. Hmm. Which is kind of at a premium these days, that kind of integrity. But it's something we all have if we choose it.
I don't know. I mean, the part I don't know about is the these days part.
Ah, interesting.
There's an ongoing conversation my wife has that with another individual that, you know, are things really different or they've always been this way?
Yeah.
And, you know, it could be that, you know, that kind of feeling of lack of integrity is not necessarily unique to our time and place.
I agree with that.
Mm.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my grandpa on my dad's side used to say, times change, people don't.
Mm-hmm.
And
I like that.
That's good.
The cynical side of me really, that appeals to that a lot. But does it matter? Does it matter for what you're going to do?
No, right. It doesn't matter at all. I mean, the point you made, which is, you know, being able to break out of that and do it is empowering for yourself, and it doesn't matter whether time or whether people change or not. The thing that's important is you've changed yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sense of personal transformation.
Mm.
To me, what I really value about an experience in nature, and what I think sticks with me more than anything else as I grow into the rest of my life, is really less a lesson learned so much as an experience that is totally unique and that will stay with me for the rest of my life. It's that wordless presence that I was talking about before, where you have an encounter in nature and it takes your breath away. And there's something about that that is transformative and changes how you're going to live the rest of your life.
Mm.
Once you know that that is possible in life and that you are able to go out and find that experience, or at the very least, that you're able to be open to that experience. Because there's two parts of it. There's one, there's the experience coming to you, but there's also you being receptive enough to notice it, to recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has something really important to say about who you are and how you're going to live your life. And I don't know, there's just something that's permanently memorable and transformative about going out into the woods and just having an experience that no one else is going to experience, and it's just a precious gem that will be with you forever.
Hmm.
Well, I was here. This is where the location where we're at is actually my grandparents' cabin.
They have good taste, by the way.
Thank you. And so I've been here.
The end of a long road.
I've been up here a number of times throughout my life, and about 7 years ago, roughly 7 years ago, I remember walking out along the gravel road that leads out to here and kind of striking off the path into the woods. There's no path, just going, following my nose. And I came upon this one particular tree. It was a big tree with a wide girth to its trunk and a beautiful spanning canopy. Other people might not have noticed it for anything in particularly special. It wasn't enormous, but to me it just really struck me at that moment, and I was moved, and I just decided that I wanted to do something to mark this. And so I started gathering stones, and I made a stone circle around it. And it took me about it was like a whole afternoon's worth of labor. Hmm. And I knew that, you know what, I'm probably never going to be able to find this spot again.
No one else may ever see it again.
And no one else may ever see it again. But that didn't really matter. And I tried to mark it a little bit. I took some stones out by the gravel road that maybe I would be able to find them again. I thought, you know, this is going to be gone in one winter's time. But you never know. Today I went out and I tried to find it. I couldn't, of course. But somewhere out there, there's that stone circle and there's that tree. And there's nothing to replace an experience like that.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you talk about one of the things I heard out of there that struck me was that of perception. You know, you're having this spiritual experience and you perceive that. And I've been asked by some people, you know, why did you become a priest? And to me, I couldn't deny the spiritual experiences I was having.
Mm, yep.
And these things happen on a day-to-day everywhere, whether you're in the city, whether you're in the wilderness, no matter where they are, they happen. But most people don't see them. They're oblivious. They're invisible. Whatever it is that they are, I don't mean to be derogatory. They're not seeing that kind of, or they're not sharing that kind of experience with themselves. And to me, it's that perception of spiritual experiences that are happening all around you. That was the reason that I chose the path I was on. Hmm. And it just strikes me that I hear that with you. You know, you're doing your own thing, which is different than my thing, but yet that part of it is common between us.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, being true to yourself and your experience.
And being able to recognize it.
Yes.
For something that's actually happening in our lives.
And to value that.
And to value that, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And to have the confidence, as Drew was saying, to go against whatever other people might be saying about it and say, no, this is important to me and to life. Mm. So I want to thank my guests today, Drew Jacob, author of Rogue Priest and Walk Like a God.
And I'm going to put in a quick plug, roguepriest.net. Check it out sometime.
And Urban Haas, author of Chasing the Ason. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, that's fine.
And what is the Ason, by the way?
The Ason is the rattle that the voodoo priest holds, or priestess for that matter, that they shake to get the attention of the spirits, draw them to them.
Right. And once again, I'm B.T. Newberg, editor at Humanistic Paganism. So check us all out. Little plug. Never hurts. So I think we're going to enjoy the rest of this night and the stars and the fire and the silence all
around. The moons.
Thanks for listening.
Have a good night, everybody.
Good night.
This has been Encounters in Nature, an open-air dialogue in the North Woods with Celtic polytheist Drew Jacob, voodoo priest Urban Haas, and humanistic pagan B.T. Newberg. Encounters in Nature is a production of Humanistic Paganism. http://humanisticpaganism.wordpress.com
Oh, yeah.